Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. This is Triangulation, episode 365, recorded July 27th for September 21st, 2018. David Ewalt, Defying Reality. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Grammarly, the communication tool that helps improve your writing for every occasion. Start writing more confidently for work, school, and even on the go. It's a great way to double-check your important papers, documents, and even avoid future typos. Get 20% off Grammarly Premium today at grammarly.com/triangulation. And by ZipRecruiter. Most job boards overwhelm you with tons of wrong resumes. Not smart. ZipRecruiter finds the right people for you and actively invites them to apply. Smart. Try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Triangulation. This is the show where we sit down with people who are writing amazing things about all facets of the world of technology. Some people are writing things. Some people are doing things. Some people are doing it all, as is the case with today's guest, David Ewalt. He's the author of Defying Reality, the inside story of the virtual reality revolution. How are you doing, David?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I've been having a lot of fun reading your book. It's a fantastic book. Came out just a few days ago, basically, right? July 17th.
Yeah, July 17th. Yeah, it's brand spanking new.
Right on. Cool. And this has got to be a lot of fun because I know, at least in my day-to-day job here at Twit, one of the things that I feel very fortunate about is that my job is intrinsically, you know, intertwined with the things that I'm passionate about in my personal life. And VR is definitely on that list. I've had a growing fascination for VR and a lifelong fascination with it in many of the same ways that I realize you did through reading the book. It's kind of like, oh yeah, me too. So it really seems like this is just something that's followed you around for a number of reasons throughout the course of your life.
Yeah, I mean, I was one of those kids who read William Gibson's Neuromancer and saw those early movies like The Lawnmower Man and Johnny Mnemonic. And I was super into the whole cyberpunk genre and all the depictions of VR that appeared in 80s and 90s fiction, and always wanted to try it, always wanted it to work the way it worked in books and movies, and was always disappointed when it never actually worked that way. So part of the excitement of this book has been discovering, oh wow, it's finally here. Like, there is stuff that we saw in the movies and books. Like, we're getting there.
Yeah, one thing I love about good science fiction is, as strange and not likely to happen in my lifetime science fiction can be, what we realize over the course of many years is that, I mean, you wait long enough and these things are very prescient, and many things that are happening in the world of VR, I still feel like there's a lot of unanswered promises in VR still at this point, but many of the things that with the early push of VR that we saw, the earlier push, I think in the 90s, you know, around the time of Johnny Mnemonic and Lawnmower Man and everything, there was a little bit of excitement. It couldn't quite live up, but a lot of those promises are finally kind of being tackled now. We're at a point where technology is capable of allowing us to be so immersed in this realistic world that we can kind of escape from our own.
Yeah, it's funny to look at what we got right and got wrong. You look at some of those depictions of virtual reality, and you've got guys wearing like full body motion capture suits, and they're going into these strange alien virtual worlds where they're traveling to like boxy constructs that represent mainframes, and like the internet is so much more advanced than that, and that's not the primary way that we're ever going to access the internet. Nobody foresaw browsers, but like the other stuff, like, okay, well, we can put on a headset now and go into a virtual world and really feel immersed and really feel like we are in this other place. Like, that's the stuff that's really come true.
Yeah, absolutely. In reading your book, it's an easy read. The way that your writing style, your excitement about the topic, obviously makes it very easy to go through. It feels part history book, and much of it is very recent history, I would add, but probably the last couple of years, very focused on Palmer Luckey and the rise of Oculus and everything. So part history book, part love letter to this technology in general. And you actually go in the very beginning, you start off with something that I had never heard of before. It was the hardware that you found in your parents' house.
The old stereoscope.
Yes, the old stereoscope.
Yeah.
The very old one. Like that feels like it's probably a collector's item at this point.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They go on eBay for a couple $100 usually. And that's one of the things that was surprising to me putting this together. I mean, I came into this world professionally as a journalist. I wrote a cover story about Palmer Luckey for Forbes. But then as I started looking more into the tech, I realized this is not new. Okay, right. The Oculus Rift is new, but people have been trying to create immersive entertainment for a very long time. And part of that is you can go back to stereoscopes, which were invented, at the very beginning of the 20th century, really into the 19th century, where you put up the thing in front of your face and it would push two pictures together and make it look 3D. Sort of the same theory that we use with the tourist goggles with
Viewmaster.
That's what I was looking for. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is nothing inherently new. For a long time, people have been trying to find ways to make images and pictures look 3D to actually put you into it. You could go back even way further than things like the stereoscope, but that was one that struck home to me because there was always one in my house growing up. Like my dad had this old dusty stereoscope in his office and I didn't know what it was. I just knew it was old and my Nintendo was much more interesting until now when I'm like, oh, wait, this is sort of weirdly an ancestor of the Nintendo. It's a strange journey that this technology has gone on.
Absolutely. Now, is that stereoscope going to end up on the shelves that are behind you? It looks like you have at least the beginnings of a VR museum going on back there.
My gallery of fame back here. Yeah, I've got all the headsets now, and at some point I'm going to sneak into my dad's office, and that stereoscope will become mine.
That'll be an exciting time. This was the Holmes scope. That was the word that I was looking for that you mentioned in the book specifically. Yeah, super cool stuff. And I remember being a kid and having the Viewmaster and just how magical that felt to see things in three dimensions. It's interesting how our perception of what being transported to another world is as we go along and kind of our tastes and our experiences evolve, right? Like when I was a kid, I remember looking through a Viewmaster and feeling like I was there in Disneyland because I think we had a set of Disneyland, experience Disneyland as if you were actually there. And it felt like I was at the theme park. Now I'd look at it and I have a completely different perspective on that. That all shifts.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it seems so quaint to us now, but things like that home stereoscope, when those came out, people literally wrote essays about, we'll never need to travel again.
Right.
Travel is over. Tourism, the tourism industry is done because the city of Paris can just publish a stereoscope card of what Paris looks like in 3D. And that's all anybody's ever going to need. And that was the thing that people were really serious about. Like, this is it. This is immersion. It's as good as being there. And of course, now it's like, it's nothing like it. But it makes me wonder what people are going to say about, the Vive and the Rift 50 years from now. We think it's so impressive, but it's nothing compared to what's coming.
No, absolutely not. If this is where we're at right now and technology grows and expands at the rates that it has proven to, man, we've got a whole lot of awesome stuff to look forward to. Maybe there will be a time where these kind of virtualized experiences are as good from a sensory perspective to make it feel like it's less necessary to actually travel somewhere. Well, that'd be kind of sad if that were the case. And I guess that's kind of part of what Ready Player One was all about to a certain degree. Do you think that's a reality that at some point we might actually hit, maybe even in our lifetimes?
I think definitely within our lifetimes, we're going to see parts of that. For instance, I work at home. It's my home office. But every now and then, I have to go from Brooklyn into Manhattan to sit down in a meeting with someone. And I like going to a sit-down meeting because it's good to be face-to-face with somebody. You have eye contact. You can see their body language. Like, it's a better experience than having a video conference or a phone call. There's a real reason to sit down with people in the same place. But virtual reality technology is already getting so good that it can do things like eye tracking and motion capture. So all those things that I want of an in-person meeting can be simulated really easy in a virtual space. And I would not be the least bit surprised if 5 years from now, you know, at the most like 10, people are going to use virtual conferencing all the time. It will replace that kind of travel to like, well, why go to a meeting? We can have that experience of being in the same space and sharing space and feeling like we're each present, but we can do it in this virtual world. Virtual tourism is going to be great for a lot of people too. You know, we all, you know, can understand the benefits of physical travel. And I don't know how long it's going to take before VR can simulate everything of travel. You know, we're probably talking about direct brain interfaces or something before like they can give you the smell and the feel and everything else of travel. But, you know, what if you don't have that much money? If you've got a VR connection, you can experience things around the world that you never would have the opportunity to otherwise. So maybe, you know, you live in a third world country, maybe you're in Africa and, you know, you finally have gotten some sort of portable VR headset. You're never going to be able to travel to Paris or to the Great Wall, but now you can experience it in a very real way that's almost as good as being there. And I think that's going to be real common.
Yeah, absolutely. It really seems like that's kind of the direction at some point that we're going to hit. We see a little pieces of that too, right? Like, you know, in the world of immersive video and VR in general, putting on a pair of goggles, you can either go the gaming direction or you can go the shared, you know, the experience direction. You can go the social direction where you're sitting in a virtualized space talking with a number of people. AltSpace is just one example of that. And I think the first time I played around with AltSpace, like my mind was kind of blown there where it was like, I don't know if I have a personal need for this in my life at this point, but I can absolutely see how this could be very, like this could solve a lot of people's maybe social anxiety problems or, I mean, just a number of things that like I don't understand yet. We aren't as accustomed to these experiences yet, but we will be. They will become increasingly more comfortable and less awkward or strange or different. And in that regard, then it removes kind of the stigma behind that. And yeah, there's so much to look forward to.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. And I think you're hitting on one of the reasons why this technology is so powerful is because, I mean, you and I are having a conversation right now, live video. I can see you. You can see me. In a lot of ways, it's intimate that way. Like, yeah. I can see you nodding. I can, you know, we're making a physical connection in a way. But you go into one of these virtual spaces like AltSpace or VR chat. And even though the avatars right now are not as good as what we're seeing in this video conference. Like if you and I were in AltSpace, I wouldn't see you. I would see this weird polygonal robot avatar thing, which is not as good. But the trick is the VR gives you a sense of presence. I wouldn't see you, but I would feel like I was actually in a room with something that represents you. Mm-hmm. And that's something really powerful that we don't really understand yet. And I think it's speaking to like the lizard parts of your brain. Like something in your brain is like, okay, this is an actual physical meeting. This person is here with me. And you tend to connect with that person in a way that we're unused to because we don't get it when we're staring at a screen. But when the person in front of you is 3D and appears to be actually present and their body has weight, it's a strangely powerful experience. Even now, when it's still very basic, it's powerful and it's only going to get more powerful.
Yeah, it's a kind of sidewires your brain into, even though on one level you understand that it's not real, on another level, it's hard for your brain to discern the difference. I mean, you know, when we hear stories about people who are in a virtualized environment in VR, you know, in a social setting, and maybe they're harassed in a certain way or whatever. And when they walk away from that experience, at their core, they feel as if it really happened in a real space. Maybe it would be one thing to see words on a screen. It's another thing entirely to have that experience, even though you know it wasn't, you know, anything more than a digital representation of something. It can feel equally as violating.
Yeah, I think so. What I keep coming back to with this is that, you know, we have sort of two levels of brain function. You can have the sort of self-aware level of like, I know this isn't real, or also I know this is just some troll on the internet writing words on a screen. But there's also a part of your brain that doesn't understand what the internet is, doesn't understand what computer graphics is. So especially with something like VR, even though I might be consciously aware, okay, this isn't real, part of my brain still thinks it's real because it looks real, it sounds real, it seems real. So it has that extra level of power to it, which can be very positive or in some ways could be negative too, because it's going to get people to take these simulations much more personally than they might, you know, with something just on their phone or on a tablet.
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of mentioned a little bit ago, your book dives in not just current, like in the last couple of years, history, but really kind of goes back. And we talked a little bit about the stereoscope and all that kind of stuff. One thing I really enjoyed was kind of revisiting this idea of the old school 3D movies. When I was a kid, you know, I wasn't around, obviously, when movies like House of Wax and Creature from the Black Lagoon were created back in the 1950s. But I do remember as a kid, specifically, I have this very vivid memory of it being Halloween, and the movie, I think it was the first Canadian 3D movie called The Mask, was on television, and you could go to the grocery store and they'd give you the 3D glasses to watch. And the cool thing about that movie, and why it kind of ties into this discussion, is that it tended to use 3D less as this is a 3D movie sort of convention, and more as you are a participant in this when you put the goggles on. Everything was 2D until one point where I think the doctor comes along and says, put on the mask, and that's your cue to put the glasses on. Once you do that, everything gets 3D and very kind of, you know, tripped out and spooky and everything like that, and it transports you into this other world. It was really fun reading that portion of the book and remembering just how big of a deal that probably was. Well, that definitely was for me when I was a kid, but probably was even a bigger deal back in the 1950s when people first saw this with their own eyes.
I mean, people who didn't live through that period, you know, we don't have a real understanding of how big 3D movies were for that period in the 50s. Like, it was a legitimate craze. Like, within a space of just a couple years, there was dozens of 3D movies that came out. It was the hottest thing happening. And it was because it was such a profound experience for people to be like, I have literally never seen anything like this before. There's flames coming at me out of the screen, and Godzilla's hand is coming this is before Godzilla, but the monster's coming straight at me. Like, it was really profound and powerful. And it's interesting to me that you describe like what happened in The Mask, that it's pulling you into the story less than just throwing something at you. You know, a lot of what we've seen in 3D movies has been literally like,
here's a yo-yo, here's a knife.
Exactly. They're throwing a frisbee around and it comes straight at your face, and you kind of jump. And that's a thrill, but it's a cheap thrill. But really good 3D, I feel like, just draws you in so you feel immersed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a while old now, but when Avatar came out and that was, you know, had this phenomenal 3D, the things about that in that 3D in that movie that I found most compelling were not even the action sequences. It was things like they're in the command center and the big bad guy is describing how they're going to kill the Na'vi and they've got the computer screens and everything. It was just super compelling to me because the screens kind of came out and you felt like you were in that command room. Like, it just made you in the movie without throwing stuff at you. And that's also what VR cinema is going to do, is it's not just about throwing stuff in your face. It's just putting you in the scene and making you forget, oh, I'm actually in a theater, or I'm actually in my living room. I'm in this story. It's very, very cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges there, too. In the sense that, you know, VR as a cinematic platform, obviously, you know, where are you looking? Where is action happening? Do viewers who are used to a very passive experience, do they want to work for that type of entertainment? Of the stuff that you've seen so far, because I know there have been a handful of things, and I've definitely seen some things that were interesting, but I'm not entirely convinced that this is like the next wave of cinema. What do you think?
Well, I think it's real early. I mean, the comparison is to compare this to the early days of black and white talkies. You know, when those movies first started coming out, they treated them like plays. They would set up a camera, the actors would walk out in front of the camera and deliver their lines to each other and then sort of walk off. There was no plotting. There was no shots. There was no close-up and 1-2 cameras. Like, it was just a play that we're recording on film. I think that's where VR film is right now. It's just such a brand new medium and has so much potential. People don't really know what to do with it. I have seen some cool stuff. I mean, a lot of what people are doing with VR filmmaking now is basically just not even VR as much as 360-degree filmmaking. A lot of people would say that's not virtual reality. I think that's probably just dribbling. But that's the idea of we've got a camera, a 360-degree camera, and so you put the headset on and you can look wherever you want in the scene. And that's cool. And in a lot of ways, that's powerful. A lot of journalists have used this. The New York Times is doing a lot of VR journalism. And what they'll use that for is like they did a VR film that won an Emmy by sending cameramen to shoot like the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. And so they had cameras in Sudan and in Syria and stuff like that. And it was powerful because we can read all we want about how hard it is for Syrian children. But when you're actually there and it looks like you're standing in this Syrian refugee camp and the crying 8-year-old kid in front of you looks like a real kid, like that's super powerful. That's taking filmmaking to another level. But then what's also exciting is some of the filmmakers are starting to realize it doesn't just have to be 360-degree video. It can be interactive and it can play out around you. And where I think VR filmmaking probably goes is like imagine a movie where dialogue doesn't start until you do something to start it. You know, maybe there's a couple sitting on the couch and they're just sort of hanging out there. And when you look at one of them and you make eye contact with that person, that's when they start their lines. Or it could be something where you move around a room and the actors are sort of waiting in the living room until you walk in. And once they know you're there, it gets going. So there's all these new possibilities. I have no idea how filmmakers are going to work that out. But these are tools that filmmakers have never had before, ways to tell stories that involve, well, where is the audience present and what is the audience doing? Is their back turned? Maybe we have the action deliberately happen when their back is turned. Like that could be a new way to surprise people. I don't know, but there's all these new tools that people are going to have to figure out.
All right, back to the interview in a second. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Grammarly. For those who aren't aware of Grammarly, you're in for a real treat. Grammarly is the communication tool that can help improve your writing and for all different types of occasions. I'm a big fan of Grammarly. I've always kind of felt like my grammar, my spelling is pretty good. But then you install something like Grammarly and it kind of monitors how you write and your writing style. And it points out the ways that you're not quite getting it right. And thankfully it's there because then suddenly you sound a whole lot smarter. It's a great way to double check your important papers and documents and even avoid future typos. They actually have a free version that you can use to get started, to try it out for yourself. It's available across platforms. So that includes online, desktop, even on your mobile device. Now, Grammarly's premium version allows users to personalize their experience settings to write for different occasions. So things like work, school, or creative. And you can have Grammarly remember new words for you. Now, in addition to spelling and grammar, Grammarly Premium helps with a whole bunch of advanced options like punctuation, advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, kind of trimming things down, and readability for different occasions. 85% of surveyed premium users identified themselves as stronger writers, and 76% now find writing more enjoyable. It kind of takes some of the guesswork out of it. And not to mention, over time, you start to see the ways that you're being corrected, and you start to realize kind of the hang-ups, the crutches that you have in your writing style. It makes you aware of that, and thankfully, that ends up making you a better writer because you make those corrections yourself. Grammarly doesn't have to intervene nearly as much, and that improves how you write. Go to grammarly.com/triangulation, and you're going to get 20% off Grammarly Premium, and you can do that today. That's grammarly.com/triangulation, and we thank Grammarly for their support. And now, back to talking about VR. We're talking with David Ewalt, the author of Defying Reality, the inside story of the virtual reality revolution. Awesome stuff in here. We could talk a lot about kind of the history that predates kind of the current era. One question that I have for you before we kind of get into this modern era of VR is about the 90s push. That's definitely a part of virtual reality history that I remember because I was young enough and old enough to understand how cool it could possibly be. And there were a lot of promises. Like we mentioned earlier, you know, The Lawnmower Man was a biggie in my book. Strange Days was another motion picture that I watched that had a certain element of VR. It maybe promised a little bit more. It was like full on sensory kind of overload and very interesting concepts within there. So a lot of promises being made about the potential of VR, but ultimately it seemed to really fizzle out and it didn't really go very far. Hasbro had something that I hadn't heard of until I read your book, the Hasbro Home Virtual Reality System that they developed more than 3 years, $59 million of funding, yet never launched. So there was all this promise, all this development. Why did it fail so hard in the 90s?
Well, it basically comes down to it made you sick. I mean, there's lots of business reasons.
Yeah.
There was lots of inexperience involved. I mean, some of the really important and great companies, Jaron Lanier, who's really one of the fathers of virtual reality, and he had his company, VPL, that crashed and burned and went bankrupt. And part of why that happened is because he's an engineer, he's a genius, and he admits himself he did not know how to run a company. So there was reasons like that. But I think fundamentally the problem with VR, why it crashed in the 80s and then why it crashed even harder in the 90s, is that the technology was not ready yet. And virtual reality needs to be especially convincing, because if it's bad, it makes you sick. It gives you motion sickness. It makes you throw up. That's not true of other technologies. You know, when the first generation of home video game consoles launched in the late 70s, early 80s, it wasn't like if I bought an Atari 2600 and I didn't like the ET game, I might hate the game, but the ET game did not literally make me throw up. But
it may have made someone throw up. It was pretty bad.
But like, it would not make you. It would not make you sick. It would not give you migraines. Yeah. The problem was a couple of major technical problems. One was that the screens, the digital screens, weren't high resolution enough. A lot of times they were still using cathode ray tubes. It was just not high resolution enough, so it didn't look real. But then also VR needs to let you turn your head and move around, and the computers and the rendering software were not fast enough so that I could look straight ahead and have an image that looked sort of convincingly real. But the minute I turned, it would take the computer a second to catch up. So you'd have the image here, and then you'd turn, and then the image would go over. And that lag in the image updating is one of those things that would just make people super sick. And it was an unsatisfying experience. It took technology evolving through the 90s to today to really make VR feasible. And that was through things like the rise of smartphones. You know, suddenly we've got low-cost, really high-resolution screens that can put a convincing image in front of your face and that can also update very quickly. A big thing that doesn't get enough credit in this is the video game business. The rise of 3D animation software and 3D video games, they built the software. They made it possible for, yes, now if I turn my head, the software updates fast enough that you don't get that lag and you don't get that sickness. So really, the technology just had to get better and better and to fall into place. And finally, in the last couple years, we sort of had all the ingredients. The technology had caught up to our aspirations after all this time.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point that I hadn't considered. Like, everyone knows that Nintendo's early foray into this was a piece of hardware that basically nobody bought called the Virtual Boy. And if you ever used it, which I know you did.
Right here.
Yeah. I mean, it would give you headaches. It promised, I think people, I don't even know if Nintendo promised a lot with it, but anyone that saw it at the time that it was releasing expected a lot from it. They were like, wow, this is going to be, you know, a virtual experience similar to my Nintendo. And then when you played it, you were so horribly disappointed by what you actually got. And, you know, it never really occurred to me that the development of video games from the time the NES and the Virtual Boy were a thing versus where we are now and where we, you know, got to when the PlayStation 1 came out and suddenly, you know, this full 3D kind of gaming became way more prevalent. There was a little bit of that on the Super Nintendo and earlier systems, but I mean, that was when it really kind of exploded. That almost needed to happen in order for us to have this like perspective shifting capability inside of a world. And I just hadn't considered that before right now. That's a very interesting point.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, you really have to give credit to the guys who designed all that 3D software and built those tools. And it's not a coincidence that the early leaders, the people who are making VR hardware and software right now, also come out of the video game industry.
Right.
It's because that's where the expertise is.
Yeah. Do you think that video games, because I know this is an argument that comes up a lot, is you know, what's going to catch on? What's going to be the thing that makes this all 100% consumer palatable? Is it the video game industry that makes VR what it's going to be someday, or is it something different? Is it virtual tourism? Is it pornography is another, you know, aspect of this? Like what is the thing that really takes VR to the next level?
Well, I think like video games are the first entrance. I mean, that's the people who are already doing it. There's a reason why one of the best-selling headsets is the PlayStation Vita. It's because 3D video games totally make sense. They're exciting. And also, video gamers are often bleeding-edge consumers. They're the ones willing to go try something new. Now, video games are an immensely powerful and popular medium. The video game industry is bigger than the global music industry at this point. Like, video games are huge.
That's a lot of money
that
there.
Said... Everybody plays video games, but most people around the world don't play PC games or console games. They're playing apps on their phones. They're doing, you know, stuff like, you know, Peggle and things like that. So I don't think that video games are going to be the killer app, the thing that gets everybody using VR. I think it's much more likely to either be some sort of visual entertainment, like VR movies or TV, or VR porn. Let's not, you know, forget that previous technologies like video cassette recorders, that whole revolution was driven by porn. People wanted to rent porn and have it in their house. Look at what we're on right now. Video streaming over the internet owes a huge due to pornography. Those guys were really first movers in a lot of ways, figuring out how to digitize content and present it in a reasonable way, streaming over the internet. Beyond all that, one other thing I think might be the killer app is some sort of social applications. I mean, we talked about Altspace. We talked about video conferencing. VR chat is out there now. I think the minute somebody comes up with a really good social VR experience, something that resembles The Oasis from Ready Player One or the Metaverse from Neal Stephenson's books. Like when there's really a thing where I can go into the social world and see my friends and where it's copying my facial expressions and it's tracking my eyes and my hands. Like the minute we have a really good social VR experience, I think that's the one that everyone is going to want to do. That's the one that my mom is going to log into. She's not going to get on my Vive and play Beat Saber, but when she realizes that she can go into VR and like literally see my face and see my expressions and talk to her grandkids and kids and stuff like that, that's the killer app, I think.
And that's certainly what Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg thinks as well. He's a notable fan of the technology, of VR technology. Obviously, Facebook bought Oculus, acquired Oculus a few years ago, and that was the driving force behind it, I think, you know, is that the long-term vision that Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook have about this is that in the future people will be using the internet to be social in the ways that you're talking about, and what better way to make that presence believable and you know, explore this new world than with VR, whatever that happens to be. I'm still not entirely convinced in this idea that there can be mass market acceptance in something that requires all the setup and the big clunky hardware and stuff. It almost needs to get miniaturized in my mind, and way easier to do for that to take place. But that doesn't mean that I don't believe that it will eventually.
Yeah. I mean, just look at cell phones. I mean, when cell phones first came out, they were giant bricks or they were attached to some big pack that you had to have in your car. That's why they were car phones, not cell phones.
Right.
They were huge. Right now, headsets are big and wonky and have a the trail of cords coming out of them, and you've got to have sensors all over your room. Like, you can't see them, but I've got four different sensors for different VR things here in this room, up on the wall. Don't tell my landlord that I'm drilling holes in the wall and hanging these things. But yeah, it's kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
But where we're getting to is there will be lighter weight, just like a pair of sunglasses or a pair of swim goggles. And that's not far away at all. I think just the next generation, probably later this year into next, of headsets, the Vive and the Rift are going to do away with those cords. There's already a wireless adapter for the Vive that you can buy, so you don't have the cords trailing. All that stuff's going to go away very quickly, and it's going to become something that you don't have to be a super geek to set up, or you don't have to give up part of your house to have this stuff. And it'll get there real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, in this new phase of VR that we're in right now, one of the early, if not kind of like the reason that this phase seems to exist right now, is Palmer Luckey. Palmer Luckey, you spend a lot of the book. I'd say the majority of the book focuses in many ways on Palmer Luckey, but that's because you had pretty good access to Palmer Luckey in your work with Forbes, right?
Yeah, I did a one of the first cover stories on Palmer for the magazine a little bit after they did their big Kickstarter where the Rifts first started getting attention. And I focus a lot on them just because obviously they are one of the most important companies in this space right now. They're the one that Facebook bought for $2 billion. They're at the center of all this, but also because Palmer is just such an interesting character. And I think yeah. ties in a lot of ways to, you know, the guys who brought us earlier technologies. I don't know if people know much about like the invention of television, but there was a young kid named Philo Farnsworth who invented this thing and soon afterwards got the technology sort of taken away from him by a rich dude who ran a media company, and then Philo sort of disappeared into obscurity. And I'm definitely seeing some increasing a correlation between the Palmer Luckey story and what some of these previous entrepreneurs are doing. But Oculus, as much as Valve and some of these other companies involved right now, is they're the ones really pushing this technology forward. And the Rift, I think, was super important because it was the first headset of this new generation. For a lot of people, it was the first time they tried a VR headset and was like, whoa, are you kidding me? Like, this actually works. You have VR that works. And they really broke ground in a lot of ways.
And even before people had the ability to try this, one thing I definitely gained from this book was a better understanding, a better perspective of Palmer Luckey as an individual and as a technologist and just driver of this technology. You really get a sense from the book how genuine his interest has been along the way, not in necessarily enriching himself, because for much of the time that seemed to be a very low priority for him. It was all about making, you know, taking his obsession with VR from his childhood and figuring out some way to make it a reality. You talk about kind of his involvement with the forums and, you know, in the forum community, and he's working on prototypes, not because he's looking to market it or turn it into a company. He's just doing it because, like, he's having fun with it and he's pulling in all the information and help from these, you know, these other people around the world who are all participating on a forum and just want to see him succeed. It was an interesting kind of window into how Oculus was born.
Yeah, Oculus is really interesting because Palmer is a very 21st century entrepreneur. He did not get involved in this because he was like, this is my way. This is the way I'm going to be a billionaire. No, he was obsessed with the Matrix and Neuromancer and video games, super into like the Final Fantasy series. He was a geek and he had seen VR in all of these different fictional things and then got to try it somewhere and was like, this sucks. This isn't anything like in the books. He was an engineer. He was a really talented teenager. So he was like, you know what? I'm going to see if I can make something better. And he created a forum where he shared this information with other enthusiasts. And it was for them all about like, well, why don't we make this thing that we all want to play with? And in fact, some of the early forum posts when he started putting together the Oculus Rift, he was saying to people, here's what I'm working on. Here's the project. I might raise a little money to help get the hardware out, but I'm thinking I'm just going to give away the design and the hardware when it comes out. And it's funny to go through some of those forum posts because people are literally posting on there, Palmer, listen, you should sell this. Like, this should be a company. Don't just give this away. You've got something really powerful here. And so, the company was really born out of that hobbyist and hacker ethos of, like, we're building this because it's something we want for ourselves. And then it becomes an even more interesting story because then, you know, modern international mass business comes in and changes the story stuff and how, like, these hackers adapt and how they fit in with the corporate world. And that's still evolving. But just the way it got started, yeah, it's fascinating. It's a different kind of entrepreneurship story than we've seen a lot in history.
Yeah, and it was really interesting to me that he was able to do this at such a young age. Like, he was able to be successful creating something from the ground up, you know, and that has such a storied history as far as what people expect. He was able to do that, and seemingly, I realized there was a lot of work that went into it, but seemingly with little, like, effort, you know, like, true, like, I've got to figure this out. You know, it really kind of seemed kind of fluid and like it was just born out of passion and like, I'm having fun with it. At some point, it became obvious that, you know, it should become something larger. They started the Kickstarter, and then John Carmack came into the scene, and that was obviously a big game-changing moment.
Yeah, that was huge. I mean, once the Rift was a thing and Palmer was like, okay, we should start a company and we should try to get this out there, the involvement of people like John Carmack was so huge. Carmack was actually on the forum that Palmer had created, one of these internet forums talking about VR. Carmack was just one of the guys on there. And when he saw Palmer talking about his headset and what he created, he messaged Palmer and said, hey, do you mind if I check that out? And, like, when the dude who wrote all of id software, who wrote Doom, when the guy who wrote Doom says, can I play with your hardware? You're like, yeah, of course.
I think you say so, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And Carmack saw it and loved it, and he took it to E3 and showed it off to other people in the video game industry. And that was that first moment of other people in the power to do something with it.
Right.
Saw the technology and were just blown away and were like, okay, wow, great. What is this? Where can we invest? Where can we buy it? And then with the Kickstarter, guys like Gabe Newell from Valve had a video there as part of the Kickstarter page. And, like, that's why the Kickstarter blew up, not because Palmer was that famous or great. Like, obviously he was an interesting character, but that Kickstarter got attention because it had John Carmack attached to it, because it had Gabe Newell attached to it. Like, it was that star power and these really respected people in the industry saying, hey, this kid's got something. It really made it blew up.
Yeah, it just goes to show that you never really know who is in a forum or who is monitoring a feed in social media or whatever. You never know where that break is going to come from, and that's a pretty darn big break. I mean, that changed everything for his life. Now, you wrote a cover story. We talked about it very briefly here for Forbes magazine about Palmer Luckey. You kind of developed a relationship with Palmer Luckey. You had chats with him a number of times on the record, I'm assuming also off. What struck you about Luckey in your conversations with him over the years?
Well, one of the first things that struck me was, so I for years was a staff reporter at Forbes and talked to tons of CEOs, interviewed lots of billionaires, and you tend to get certain types. You know, they're usually very reserved, they're very controlling, they're careful about what they say, they're very businessy. Not Palmer. First things that struck me meeting Palmer and hanging out with Palmer was that he was just like one of my friends. I mean, he was literally a kid in some ways. When I first started interviewing them, he wasn't even old enough to drink when we first started talking. But even with time, after the Rift blew up and after Oculus VR became a big company, and even after the Facebook acquisition, at which point Palmer was presumably worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 to $700 million, he was still just like a normal geeky guy. You know, he would still be wearing shorts and flip-flops to his meetings. And every time I sat down with him, usually our conversations would start not talking about the company, but like what video games we were playing, you know, about where, you know, what he thought of the new Pokemon game, or if he was enjoying, you know, the new Far Cry game. Like, he seemed like he was still very much the person he had been before he got famous and rich. And I think even now, I think that's still the case. He doesn't seem like he's gone, you know, gone Hollywood, to borrow an expression. He really still is, you know, he's got that hacker ethos, and you know, he's gotten attention for some of his political views, and that kind of also burned him at his time at Facebook. But I think even with that stuff, whether you agree with him politically or not, like, you have to appreciate, like, he's still who he is. Like, he's just like kind of a geeky child of the internet. Like, that's, he's the, you know, people in internet forums, those are his people, and that's like his generation and just who he is, and he hasn't really changed much.
Yeah. Were you much in touch with Palmer during that whole Nimble America fiasco, as you put it in the book? Right. You know, it really seemed like Palmer, for a very long time, especially intertwined with Oculus and the Rift, was very vocal, very public. He was always out there. People, you know, he was in many ways a tech celebrity. And then everything happened around the election time, where I think he was, you know, he went on the record to say that he had funded an anti-Hillary Clinton campaign or something, some sort of billboard scenario. Maybe you can explain that better than I just did. But anyways, that really seemed to change this, like, the public coverage of him. Suddenly everybody seemed to turn on him, and then now you really hear nothing. I think I was at the Oculus Connect that he was supposed to, everyone assumed he was going to be there. He wasn't there, and that was a big surprise. Meanwhile, he had been there, you know, every year prior to that. So yeah. I don't know. What were your thoughts? Were you in contact with him around that time?
Well, around the time of the Nimble America, no, we didn't talk, because he was still at that point a Facebook employee, and the metal shutters, boom, just went down.
I'm sure.
The minute that happened, like, they just hid him away. They wouldn't let him talk to anyone. He didn't show up at, as you said, at Oculus Connect, even though he'd been on stage at all the previous ones. They just, Facebook was like, no, you are not talking to anybody. You're gone. It was an interesting thing to see play out, just because, you know, part of it was, you know, as I said, Palmer was always kind of this kid of the internet, and this is where he came out of. The Nimble America thing happened. Palmer has described himself as basically libertarian. He said he voted for Ron Paul once, and, you know, he sees himself as a libertarian, conservative libertarian. When the Trump-Clinton campaign was happening, Palmer and some other folks seem to have had the idea of, you know what, we can apply what we know about the internet, and even, like, some of the knowledge that we have of memes and trolling, and, like, this can be useful to this campaign scenario. So the minimum we know that Palmer did is he said, you know, yeah, he donated some money that was used to put up a billboard, like a road billboard that was an anti-Clinton billboard. But this organization, which he was also involved in at some level, was also, you know, there's talk about how they were doing some anti-Clinton trolling on forums and stuff like that. We don't know how much that Palmer was actually involved in, but it was strange because Palmer was the ideal poster boy. He was literally the poster boy in the sense that he was on the cover of Time magazine.
Yes.
He was on the cover of Forbes magazine. Like, he was a big selling point for the company. And for a long time, the reason why Oculus VR was getting so much attention and why people were finally taking virtual reality seriously was because there was this character involved. If the Oculus Rift had been invented by a 65-year-old white dude in a lab coat in some university somewhere, it still would have been as amazing a product, but people wouldn't have paid as much attention to it. People paid lots of attention to it because it was created by a 17-year-old, because it was this kid, and it was this kid with some attitude and a sense of humor from California. Like, that was the story that got people's attention. And for a long time, Oculus played into that. And Facebook, even after the acquisition, played into that. When they would have conferences, Palmer would come out on stage, and Palmer would show off the hardware. He'd hold it up in the air, and he'd be wearing his shirt, is his Hawaiian shirts and shorts. Like, they played him as a character because it worked, because it got people's attention. Look at what this genius kid created. But then the minute, like, he started being a little less convenient, when it started being like, well, here, you know, he's expressing his own political viewpoints, that's fine for him, but that's problematic when you're a company that's trying to have a mass market product to not offend consumers, and suddenly your poster boy is not perfect. He's not just a blank slate for your technology. He's a person with his own habits and thoughts. And so, yeah, they kind of disappeared him. And that's what eventually led to him leaving the company in part.
Yeah, he left the company. Do you think it had any impact on the success or slowdown of success of the actual Oculus Rift?
I don't think so. I mean, a lot of people, when the Nimble America stuff came out, a lot of people in internet forums were like, oh, that's it.
Yeah.
I'm never buying an Oculus product. But like, I tend to think those are people who weren't going to buy them anyway, or, you know, didn't mean it. Like, it's just, I don't really think it affected sales. It certainly didn't help Oculus's image, the company's image, but I don't think that is what hurt sales. I think sales at launch were never going to be strong. This was always going to be a product for enthusiasts. It's very expensive, at least to start. It requires a high-end computer, and I think that's why sales have been slow more than anything. Not because, you know, Palmer did something that people found politically offensive. I think that was just another wrinkle to the story for people to gossip about.
Yeah, absolutely. We're talking with David Ewald, author of Defying Reality. If you're a fan of virtual reality, the promise of virtual reality, you're going to really love this book. It's an awesome read. All right, going to take a break and thank this sponsor of Triangulation. That's ZipRecruiter. If you own a business, you know how challenging it can be to find the right people for your business. And you also know how distracting it can be when it pulls you away from the ways that you want to run your business. You want to spend your time doing the things that are most effective. If you're spending all your time hunting down people to work for you, sometimes it's not always the best use of your time, especially if it takes a long time. There are job sites that wait for the right candidate to apply to your job. And really, that's just not very smart. But you know what is smart? Going to ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation to hire the right person. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. It's actually a powerful matching technology that scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with just the right skills, the education, the experience that's needed for your job, and then actively invites them to apply. So you get nothing but qualified candidates, and it happens fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And like I said, if you run a business, you know how challenging hiring can be. It's just the challenge of finding those qualified candidates. And if you have to search a million different places to find them, it's going to take a lot of time on your part. You're probably going to miss the needle in the haystack. It's too many applicants to have to filter through. And that's how ZipRecruiter really makes it easy for you. They find them and they pass those on to you. And right now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at our exclusive web address. It's ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. That's right. It's free. That's all you need to know. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. One more time. ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation and check it out for yourself and you'll see what you've been missing. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And now it's time to dive back into that virtual world. We've spent some time obviously talking about Oculus. There are a lot of other players in this space right now. One of the big movements was this movement of mobile VR, you know, Google with Cardboard initially and then Daydream. Samsung partnered with Oculus actually and still does to this day with Gear VR. Very recently, Oculus Go, which is more of a mobile like standalone approach. What do you think about this as a side shoot? Like obviously, the more impressive hardware is the premium hardware from Oculus and HTC Vive, right, and stuff like that. When you put that on and you experience it with like room tracking and everything like that, it's mind altering. It's mind blowing. Mobile VR is kind of a step down from that, a few notches. What do you think of the differences there? And do you think it's really important?
I think you just hit on it. Mobile VR can be very cool. It's a good thing where a lot of people have had their first experiences with a mobile VR unit. I mean, Google put out their Google Cardboard, which is literally the cardboard kit that you fold together and drop your phone into it. That's phenomenal because the New York Times sent millions of those cardboard kits to their newspaper subscribers when they started doing those VR movies, those VR documentaries. And so for millions of people, that was their first exposure. Like, oh, I can put my iPhone into this and I can get this VR 360 degree experience. That's great. But the experience is nothing like what you get with the high-end headsets, with a Vive or with a Rift. And I hope that people see those mobile experiences and they're like, wow, this is exciting. I want to try more. There might also be a little bit of people tried a mobile headset and were like, that's cool, but I don't really need to spend some money on that. And that might have maybe contributed a little bit to why there's not more excitement about the high-end headsets. But I think ultimately what happens, we're already seeing with, as you mentioned, the release of the Oculus Go. The Oculus Go is a portable headset, but it's not one that you put your cell phone into. It's got its own dedicated screen, its own onboard computer. It's an all-in-one device. It is not as good an experience as an Oculus Rift because it has head tracking, right? So it can tell which way you're looking. But if you move backwards or forwards or walk around the room, the Oculus Go doesn't track that. So it's still not as good as the next step up, but it's better than those mobile phone-based VR systems. And I think there's going to be more headsets like the Oculus Go. There's one in China now that's catching on pretty well. And I think that's sort of the stopgap thing where people will get a better experience from that and then eventually get the chance to try the big heavy hitter console, you know, or console based or PC based VR experiences. And that's ultimately what has to happen, is that more than any other technology I can think of in recent years, this is one of those you have to see it to believe it technologies. You need to go where somebody has a Vive set up and put on the headset and take the controllers in your hands and walk around the room and actually explore a virtual space. And that's when people have that, oh my God, I get it, experience, is when they get the full treatment in a room and they really get to exist in a virtual environment. Right now, it's hard to do that because the hardware is expensive and not that many people have it. Another year, another 2 years, another 5 years, it's going to be a lot more people who've got it and are able to experience that.
Yeah, a couple of months ago, I think it is at this point. So I've spent good amount of time with the Oculus Go and reviewed that. Prior to that, I spent time with the Lenovo Mirage. I'm not sure if you have the chance to do that. That's Google's first Daydream collaborative headset with WorldSense tracking. So it does allow you to kind of go, you know, go in and out and get the change in perception. It's not just rotational, rotational information, but it's actual depth when you move in and out. And that makes a really big difference. It's yet another step towards the full blown while still being completely integrated into a single headset. That was impressive. I just felt like the software support wasn't quite there. So there's always something, there's always an asterisk somewhere.
Yeah. It's just, that's one of those things where it just takes time. I mean, we've got some really cool hardware now. More people need to develop for it and there needs to be more implementations. People are always asking me like, what I want to get this, or like, I want my friends to like, what's the software, what should I do to show people? And like, there's not always a great answer because there's no super great software. There are experiences that are really impressive, but it also sort of depends on the person. You know, sometimes they're like, oh, well, try one of these painting programs, or try this first person shooter, or try one of these travel programs. Like, it's, there needs to be better support and better software, and it's happening, but you know, it's a process.
Yeah, it is a process. Another major platform, and you've mentioned it. Actually, you've been calling it the Vive. I've been calling it the Vive. So I don't know. I'm probably wrong.
It is the Vive. No, it is the Vive. I've been blaming it on my Southern origins, even though I don't think that's a legitimate Southern accent, but for some reason it always comes out my mouth as the Vive. No, it is the Vive, as in revive.
I was like, man, I've been getting it wrong all this time. So HTC Vive, now I want to say Vive, was coming along right about the same time as Oculus. And it was very much the question of the day, which one's better, you know, this one or that one. And I think the Vive was the first one to have some sort of hand tracking with the Oculus Rift. You were locked into a controller. With the Vive, you had actual hand tracking. And then later, of course, Oculus came out with the Oculus touch, and that also gave you finger control. So in the development of VR and the approach to more and more immersive experiences, which of those two systems do you think works better in that regard?
Well, as you say, they both have things going for them. I think that the Oculus Rift is a better headset. It is nicer looking. It's more comfortable on my head. The cords aren't quite as unwieldy. Like, I think it's a better experience wearing it. The Vive has the full room experience where you can actually walk around and explore an environment. Now, you get some of that tracking with the Rift, but the Vive is much more room scale, and that's crazy when you do some of those things, when you can really walk around like an entire big room and move behind things and around things. That's incredibly powerful. So that way, I like the Vive. Then you got the hand controllers, which are super important. The Rift, as you say, did not launch with hand controllers. Back then in 2014, I would have told people, you know what, go HTC, because the hand controllers are so important. But now the Rift has theirs, and I think the Oculus Touch controllers are so much better than the Vive's controllers, because they really feel like it's something in your hand. You can grip, there's buttons for each finger, so you can manipulate things, you can point, you can, you know, give the peace sign, you can do all kinds of stuff. Now, Valve has been developing with HTC a new set of hand controllers. They're called the Knuckles controllers, and they're a lot more like what the Rift has. So that's an area where they're catching up. But for now, the Oculus Touch controllers are better. If someone was going to buy one of these consoles right now, what would I recommend? Jeez, I don't know. I might recommend, if you have a lot of space in your house, I would say get the Vive, because that room scale experience is pretty awesome. If you're just going to be like on your couch and not moving around a lot, get the Rift, because the headset's way more comfortable. It looks better. The controllers are really great. You know, it just depends on what you're into as well. The software is pretty uniform. Most developers are putting out their software for both platforms at this point. I can't wait to get to the point where they're all so good and they're all so cheap that I can tell people, oh, you know, get them all.
Yeah, one of the things, one of the other systems, obviously, is the PlayStation VR, which has the benefit of all of the PlayStation 4 owners, not needing to pick up a new computer system to drive this, because that is one of the big prohibitive factors for these large-scale VR systems, is that you need to build out a computer that's capable of doing it. So that's going to stop a lot of people right there. PSVR, maybe lesser so. But PSVR has the lower resolution. It's been my belief in all of these systems is that the resolution, personally, and I get a lot of pushback from people when I talk about this, but I feel like the resolution just isn't there. For me, I want things to be super duper duper sharp, not just real, you know, sharp in moderate differences between them. I think that's when we start getting into the world, the realm where it's easier for our brains to be completely tricked, because the virtual reality looks just as defined as the real reality. What do you think about
100%.
That?
100%. I agree completely. I have my list of my three things. This is my Christmas list, the things that I think have to happen in order to make VR better and mainstream and just for it to be awesome. The first thing is the screens have to get better. The screens are great right now. You get a really cool experience in these VR things, but I want super detailed screens. Yeah. I want things to get closer to photorealistic. Right now, you can wear these headsets and they look great and things look real-ish, but you will never for a second forget that you're looking at computer-generated imagery. You can still see the pixels. Like, it's not, it's great, but it's not where it needs to be. Those need to get better. Thing number two is that the headsets need to get comfortable and smaller. And like right now, you know, even someone like me who's super into VR, like I think the longest, I just spent 2 years writing a book about virtuality. And I think the longest I've ever actually been in virtuality at once is under 2 hours. Like I cannot keep the headset on my face for more than 2 hours without my eyes completely drying out, my head starting to hurt. Like they need to get smaller and more comfortable and just better form factor. And then the third thing that's got to happen, I think, is better tracking, whether that's tracking our hands, tracking our body, tracking our facial expressions, but also especially eye tracking. That's going to happen real soon. Probably the very next generation of these headsets will all have eye tracking built in. But there needs to be a better way for the systems to know what you're doing and what you're looking at. And that's a big thing about making it real, because you can have a super photorealistic world. You can have headsets that you forget that you're wearing. But if you move your hands and the computer doesn't realize that you're moving your hands, that just breaks the reality. So we need to track better. We need better screens, and we need more comfortable headsets.
Absolutely agree. And the foveated rendering is part of that eye tracking kind of approach, rendering just what your eye is looking at, which represents in many ways the way that we actually do experience reality. Everything, you know, when I'm staring at the screen, everything in my peripheral vision, I see it, my brain can understand it and interpret it, but it's not as defined or as sharp as everything that I'm looking directly at. And there are ways to improve systems so that they replicate that experience. They can maybe ramp down resolution on the sides, make it sharp in the center. That allows the computer to keep up, you know, the CPU to keep up with more of what it's doing. And also the shifting of perspective, being able to use my eye to look at the TV and then the bookcase behind the TV and have my focus actually shift between those two dimensions. We're not quite there yet, but I have no doubt that's going to be powering the big kind of VR systems of the future. I don't know if it's the next gen, but somewhere down the line.
Yeah, it's soon. You know, there's a lot of tricks that your brain does to perceive the world as three-dimensional. And some of those things are like, well, your brain can tell things like parallax. You know, if it knows how things are moving back and closer to you as opposed to further away, and just little indications your brain gets, like, oh, this thing in the background is fuzzy and this thing up close is sharp, like that. All those little things help give your brain information about depth and about the world around you. And right now, a lot of that doesn't work real well in VR, because like you've just got a LCD screen in front of your face and everything is just in 1080p or whatever. Like, so what things like eye tracking and foveated rendering that you're talking about are going to do is allow a system to create, on one sense, if you just looked at the picture as a whole, like on your monitor, it wouldn't look as real because parts would be blurry and parts would be sharp. But like, what it's doing is it's replicating the way your eyes see the world. It's not just creating a perfect sharp photograph of the world. It's giving your eyes the information that it's used to. And that's the real trick to creating an immersive world, is to present visual information to your eyes the way your eyes are used to getting visual information.
Yeah, yeah. I just realized we're reaching the end of the time that we have. I did want to ask you one final thing, and you know, we didn't even talk about Magic Leap. You have that in your book. You spend a lot of time talking about a lot of different aspects of this stuff that we weren't able to get to. So I highly recommend people check out the book. But before we kind of wrap this up, my thought is kind of like going back when I think about the movies that really inspired me in this regard, and the fiction that really captured my imagination, Strange Days is right near the top of it. This idea that you can kind of wire in, and it's not just visual, it's full sensory, programming. Do you think that's the reality that we're heading towards? Do you think this is the precursor to something like that, and that we'll see that in our lifetimes?
Yeah, I think, in our lifetimes, probably. I mean, we have to start thinking about, at that point, you're talking about things like how fast technology accelerates. Yep. And we get into the whole idea of, the singularity and stuff like that. But yeah, I think technology does accelerate at such a point that we'll get there. The trick is to really get that sort of thing. Headsets are not enough. Like, you can't be just something in front of your face, because we have to involve your other senses. To have a really convincing simulation, you need to hear it, see it, smell it, feel it, have vibrations. Like, you've got to have everything happening. And I think the way to do that is a direct computer brain interface, which I'm certain is in the future. 50 years in the future, 80 years in the future, I don't know. But we'll get there. And I'm sure eventually, we'll have the Strange Days thing, for better or for worse. But right. I hope it's within my lifetime. But I'm pretty sure it's coming.
David Ewalt, it was a pleasure talking with you about this and nerding out on virtual reality, because I love the topic. Obviously, you do too. And it's very evident in your book, Defying Reality, The Inside Story of the Virtual Reality Revolution. Just came out, so it's hot off the presses. People should definitely check check it out. And if you like VR, it's going to be an easy and fast read. It really is. It's very enjoyable. David, thank you for hopping on today and talking with me about this.
Thank you so much. I love talking to you.
Right on. We'll talk to you soon with the next book, the follow-up when we're at the singularity, basically.
Yes.
All right.
We'll all plug in and experience better.
All right. Thank you, David. We do this show every Friday, usually at 3 p.m. Pacific, sometimes a little bit before. If you follow the Twit calendar, twit.tv/live, you can find the calendar there to see if we have some extra recordings. But we love to do this show. I love to do this show because I get to talk to some awesome people in the process. So if you want to see all the awesome people that we've talked to on this show, you can check it out by going to twit.tv/triangulation or twit.tv/TRI for triangulation. There you're going to find all the episodes, all the interviews, so you can get all caught up. Subscribe to the podcast, of course, there. We're going to talk to a lot more awesome people in the future, and I just really look forward to it every time. Thanks also to our producer, Carson. Thanks to Alex for helping here in the studio. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Triangulation. Bye, everybody.